Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello there and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, looking back at West Indies tour, England's performances in those three tests and a consolation victory, I suppose you'd say, in the end in St Lucia. Actually, England played really well. All the games quite one-sided, but I suppose overall that three-test series seems to have posed more questions in a way than it's answered. One of them would be, what is England's best top three? And we're going to invite you to suggest your own people that perhaps should play in that test match in July against Ireland, and then obviously in the Ashes after that. Simon, well, firstly, I mean, do you think it was a bit of a, not so much a consolation victory as a meaningless victory, that last test?
I don't think it was a meaningless victory, because I think if England had lost 3-0, if you sort of look at it on the negative side, if England had lost 3-0, then that would have been, you know, serious alarm bells. To go to the West Indies and be whitewashed or blackwashed, whatever you want to call it, out there in the West Indies against a side that England expected to beat, to lose 3-0, I think would have been really seriously damaging for them. So I think it was an important victory. I think it sort of seemed to lack a bit of that intensity. West Indies had won the series. I'm sure they didn't really let up, but I don't know whether psychologically that you do just ease off a bit. They didn't have Jason Holder. England, I think, you know, won a good toss and they made the most of it. And I think that's what they didn't do in their first innings in the series. They didn't dig in and try to wear the West Indies bowlers down, and perhaps they learnt more in that first innings in the third test match, and that got them to where they wanted to be. And actually, you know, when you imagine England going to the West Indies and doing well, the third test was a template for that, really, I think. Get runs on the board and then put some pressure on.
And it took them three tests to work out what was the best combination. It seemed to have the right mix of specialist batsmen, a fast bowler, Mark Wood, who obviously made a dramatic re-entry into test cricket, some good all-rounders in there, pretty much their appropriate spots, Stokes at six and so on, Moeen Ali at eight. And I just think it had more cohesion as a team, really. And they, Root obviously getting his 100, so that's only one series now in his whole career, the first series he played at home, I think, where he's never made a 50. He was in danger of failing in this series to do that, but of course got 100 in the last test. And it was interesting that, you know, Alistair Cook was saying, you know, typical of Root to get 100, in a fairly, I suppose, insignificant match in terms of the series, but just an opportunity there for him to show his class. And it wasn't the prettiest Root innings, but he got the job done excellently, and that must just give him a bit of confidence. But it's a long time now till England play another test match. It's sort of 5 months till mid-July, the test match against Ireland, Ireland's first test at Lord's, of course, as well, and first test in England, and then the Ashes following hot on the heels of that. Both teams, Australia and England, now in mid-table in the ICC test rankings. Australia just narrowly ahead of England, I think, on run rate. Both teams on 104 points. I suppose that tells you something. It tells you that they're both very inconsistent teams who've had their problems, especially away from home. Australia lost to India even at home. England, at least, record at home is a bit more unblemished, I suppose. And it all sets it up brilliantly. I mean, we tried predicting what's going to happen in the Ashes, and it's impossible, isn't it, to have any idea. Partly because it's so much cricket to be played between now and then anyway, including, of course, the World Cup.
Yeah, we don't know who's going to be fit. You've got two unpredictable sides, two sides with lots of talent, but you don't know how it's all going to come out on the day. What I would say about Roots 100 was, I mean, there was a sort of hint of sort of ruthlessness about it. You know, it wasn't the most valuable 100. England would have won, I think, without a Joe Root 100. They would have won without a Joe Root half century. Good for him. But what he did, of course, is what other players in that top four didn't do. They didn't go on. There are other players who had a chance to really stake their claim. You think of Burns, you think of Denley, who did well, but, you know, 100, you know, there's a real cachet about 100. And, of course, Jennings and Butler, who's guaranteed to play in the Ashes as long as he stays fit, of course. But, you know, I think of that top three, they didn't do what Root did. And I think there's that sort of ruthlessness about a top-class player. The other thing I think as well is that I just sense that, you know, coming into this year, the biggest things in cricket this year for England are the Ashes and the World Cup. And I'm not saying the West Indies is in the way of that, but clearly it's not the top priority. And I reckon that among those players, and there are quite a few of them in the England squad, who are, you know, white ball players as well, I think there'll be a relief in a way that the Test cricket is now out of the way and they can sort of really focus on the business end of the year or the business part of the year, which is white ball cricket and the World Cup and the build-up to that, which, you know, really starts now in earnest for England with this one-day series coming up against West Indies.
Looking back at the series, I suppose, and looking ahead as well, one of the things that will help England is that, in terms of Test cricket, is that they had a pretty poor warm-up to this series and the guys hadn't played much cricket before that. Obviously, the ones in Sri Lanka had then a month or so off before coming out to the Caribbean. Only two warm-up games. They were fairly low-key warm-up games. But in the sort of advance of the Ashes, there are potentially nine championship games in the summer. So you feel that there's a lot of opportunity there for the Red Bull specialists to really stake a claim and stick their neck out. It will be very interesting to know from you, the listeners, who you think England's top three should be for the Ireland Test match and the Ashes. I think I'm going for definitely Rory Burns. I mean, he's done enough for me to show he's certainly got the aptitude mentally for playing Test cricket. At the moment, one or two technical things perhaps have just crept in that obviously teams will look at. But playing the cut shot a little bit too freely. He's got out a couple of times like that. He doesn't bring his bat down straight on off stump at times when the bowling's from round the wicket. It's probably a type of attack that he hasn't seen an awful lot of, certainly not at that level of skill. The kind of trend for bowling round the wicket to left-handers has become, you know, almost a sort of flood, really. And it's when you get really skillful operators doing it, it's a hard thing to combat. But at the moment, his bat comes down a bit crookedly when he's playing on off stump from bowlers around the wicket. And, you know, he's got out a couple of times, clipping the ball in the air on the leg side. Of course, the classic dilemma for a batsman is that they, a couple of times, they get caught in the slips. So they think, well, I better get over to off stump a bit more to counter the movement away. And then they end up overbalancing and clipping leg stump balls in the air on the leg side. So it's a constant examination of balance and so on for a batsman. Of the others, Jennings, I'm sorry, it's just a write-off. I mean, I love the guy, but his batting, you know, if I was a bowler, I'd just want to bowl at him all day. Mm. And I've had a bit of a spat with a man on Twitter who said, how can you just write this guy off? You know, how many test matches have you played in the studio between you, i.e. none? How can you just write a guy off? But, I mean, the evidence is so categorically obvious that he just looks like a cardboard cutout against seam bowling, a wicket waiting to happen. And his first-class average, never mind his test average, his first-class average is only 33, which doesn't, to me, suggest someone who's going to make piles of runs at test level when the bowling's even better.
Yeah, I mean, he does seem quite well suited to playing in the subcontinent and not against pace attacks. He looks quite good against spinners. He's got both his hundreds in the subcontinent against Sri Lanka and India. I have to say it's hard to make an argument for him retaining his Test match spot this summer. I mean, I just don't see where the argument lies in, yeah. you know, significantly in his favour. So, you know, it looks as if there might be another slot there. Actually, I do see one argument, and that is, if not Jennings, then who?
Yes.
And that is part of the problem. There aren't obvious candidates to come in, and we've talked about it a lot, and it might well be that we don't, you know, I've said this before, and it sounds like a strange thing to say when you're picking an England team. It's not necessarily about the best candidate, it's about the least worst. And, you know, it's an odd situation for England to be in at the top of the order. What about Denley at three? Is that innings that he played, does it show you enough that he is worth persevering with?
I think it alarmed me, actually, because he did play some beautiful shots, but it just reminded me of James Vince. He just looks a bit loose for Test cricket. He does play some nice shots. He's got good balance. He's quite a fluent player, but I worry about that. His technique isn't very precise. And he looks to me a little bit, not lazy exactly, but not decisive in his defence. And I'd fancy getting him out. If I was bowling to him, I'd think, well, yeah, he might hit me for a few fours. He hits the ball nicely on the up. He's got a lovely style and he hits some gorgeous shots. But I'd always fancy myself at having a chance outside off stump. So to me, he doesn't look very secure. He does look, you know, quite fluent, quite an attractive player. But I wouldn't have an awful lot of confidence against a good bowling attack if I was coming in next.
Yeah, and you know, he's got that age factor. It's weird, isn't it, that England's top three, if you look at their averages, I know they play different numbers of test matches, they average about 25, 25 and 28. And you just want more. You just want those players who have been selected to sort of stand up and show you more and show you better numbers. Anyway, so, okay, those people listening out there who think they can pick possibly pick a better team than selectors, give us your top three. Consider it. Give us your top three for the Ashes. I have to say, I'm really struggling. I don't know where England should go. I mean, there's, what are the options? There is something like Jason Roy. I mean, if Jason Roy scored bucket load of runs in the World Cup, I know it's not like for like, and I know, you know, he's unfamiliar with the top of the order in red ball cricket, but you know, is that extra bit of class, you know, is that worth going with as a punt? I don't know. It's a problem the selectors are going to have to solve somehow and just go for something. It may well be they stick with all three, but I just don't see that necessarily as working against Australia's pace attack. Anyway, if people want to get in touch with us, what should they do, Yoza?
Well, the email address is theanalystpodcast@gmail.com. theanalystpodcast@gmail.com. Give us your suggestions for England's top three. The top three in the England Lions at the moment is Holden, Duckett and Hain. So you could pick one of those, perhaps. I quite like the idea, and though I know this is a huge kind of risk, but I'm hoping that Hazib Hamid comes back into form. I know he averaged 9 last year for Lancashire, and he's gone away to New Zealand to work on his game. He's test average is actually 40, so in the short test career he's had, and he had the makings of someone who I felt, you know, he had that dedication to the crease, which I think England desperately need. Almost a sort of Craig Brathwaite type of player who has a very low strike rate but just sells his wicket very dearly and stays in. And I think it's also going to be valuable to have a right-hander, because there are so many left-handers in the rest of the England order, with the likes of Stokes and Moeen Ali and so on, that I just feel, and Burns at the top of the order too, I just think it's good to have right-handers, because bowlers are just getting so good at bowling at left-handers. I think actually right-handers are going to have an advantage. So if a right-hander in county cricket can really put his hand up at the top of the order and make runs, and there are more championship games in the middle of the summer this year to give them a chance to play on a decent pitch rather than all the games in April and early May. So there's no excuse, I think, for someone to not put their hand up and say, look at me, I've made 700 runs, 300s in 6 games, pick me. And I just dearly hope that's the case. Just moving on to the bowling for a second, there's a quote that Ian Pont, the bowling coach, likes to use about fast bowling. You can't fire a cannon from a canoe. And what he means by that is you need stability to let go of the ball fast. And I was thinking that, actually, when I was watching Mark Wood bowl in this last test match. They had some slow-motion pictures on telly of where his foot crashes down onto the crease and he lets go of the ball, and you can see all the shock waves going through his body. It makes my teeth rattle and my spine tingle actually seeing that, because I can remember how often that happened to me. But it's so important to get that real solid position at the crease, and so that you're bowling right over the top of a brace front leg. And that's the reason why he's able to bowl fast, because even though he's got a small frame, he does really, really brace his knee on the point of release and smash his leg down, which is why he's had so many ankle problems, and bowl right over the top of his front leg. And when he gets his run up right, then he really is a handful, as he showed. And it's one of the reasons why someone like Jason Holder, the huge man that he is, can't bowl quick, because his leg buckles as he lets go of the ball. And we've seen in this test match three bowlers bowling, sort of adjusting their run-ups. Even though they're test bowlers, they've been tinkering around with their approach. So we had Stuart Broad before the test series saying he'd work with Richard Hadley to shorten his run-up. We had Mark Wood working with the England bowling coaches to lengthen his, which I think is a good thing, because it's got him more momentum into the crease and less reliant on that burst of speed off a short sort of 10-pace run-up, which he was doing before. There's more of a gradual build-up. And he really sort of explodes at the crease. And Anderson, in that last day and a half, amazingly, actually added about 4 paces to his run-up. He'd had some trouble running down the pitch and maybe hadn't felt quite in sync, but perhaps felt he hadn't quite hit the pitch hard enough. So he worked on a slightly longer run-up with a more gradual build-up to the crease. The same run-up he's had since he was 15... apart from a short spell in about 2005 where he lengthened it to try and find a bit more pace. He's had the same run-up since he was 15. And now, in the middle of a test match, he's adjusted it slightly to try and get even better. I mean, the man leaves no stone unturned in trying to find ways of improving.
It's amazing, isn't it? 575 test wickets. I mean, do you think that's a good thing, though? I mean, it's worked for him for so long, the run-up that he's had, clearly. I mean, look at his stats, look at his longevity. And now he's tinkering, at the age of 36, whatever he is.
Yeah, I would say, I think it's partly due to, running on the pitch, which is a problem. And he's maybe trying to just shorten his delivery stride slightly so that he doesn't follow through quite as far into the danger zone as he was. But I think more significantly, I think as you get older, sustaining that burst of speed to the wicket over only a few paces is harder, because your body's a bit older, you get a bit tireder. Actually, if you have a slightly longer run-up, you can build up gradually to that moment when you need to explode at the crease. And also, and this is a silly thing really, but gives you a bit more time when you walk back as well, because you've actually got a little bit further to go. It's only, a matter of a couple of seconds or 5 seconds, but actually that can all help just to pace yourself a bit more and get through the over.
What about Stuart Broad then, shortening his run-up?
Yeah, well, Stuart Broad shortening his run-up, That sometimes the key to getting over the top of your front leg, which he hasn't always done very well, is to, and what I mean by that is that your body is bolt upright as you let go of the ball rather than leaning back a tiny bit in release. One way of doing that is to shorten your delivery stride slightly. And I always felt with him, he looked as if he was straining to get to the wicket a bit and sort of overstriding. So shortening your delivery stride a touch shortening your run-up a touch can then shorten your delivery stride, shorten your stride pattern a tiny bit, and hopefully you hit the crease at a slightly more upright position, which helps in terms of pace and rhythm and also bounce, because you're bowling from slightly taller.
So different things for different bowlers, really, different strokes for different folks, really.
Yeah,
It would be remiss of us to not touch on the West Indies and have a look
absolutely
at them. Jason Holder, their captain, didn't play in the last test match, saying our goal is to be world number one. Now there's a World Test Championship coming up, and so there'll be points on offer for future test series, not immediately, but for test series after the World Cup, and England against Australia is the first one of those, first in the Test Championship. Realistically, West Indies as world number one, how much improvement do they need to make? And I suppose they've got to knock, you know, a team like India off. I mean, actually, if you look at West Indies, one of the things that happened before they came into this series, they went to Asia, they lost in India comfortably, they lost in Bangladesh comfortably. So that, you know, that's something to address for them, surely.
I think they haven't got enough class in the batting. You know, they've got the bowling attack. They've got reasonable spinners. I mean, Ross and Chase isn't a great spinner, but he's steady. And they've got that left-arm spinner as well that didn't play, but who is someone... Yeah, Warrican, who's obviously got something. But I just feel their batsmen, generally, their top order... I mean, Craig Brathwaite is effective, but he's someone... You know, you wouldn't mind him staying in, really, because he's not going to hurt you too much. Shea Hope has been a disappointment, only averaging 23. He's struggled generally. Technically, I thought he looked, you know, a bit vulnerable outside off stump, and actually also vulnerable when the ball nipped back as well. So he's not convincing to me. John Campbell, quite a nice discovery. He could certainly improve. But, you know, if they're relying on people like Roston Chase at number five to get them out of situations, Hetmyer's obviously talented, but if you compare their batting order to the power and experience of India and just skill of India as well, they're nowhere near, are they? So I think their bowling attack is pretty good, but their batting would still worry me, and they're in eighth position in the test rankings at the moment. They've got to score significantly more runs, big scores, to make inroads in that table and be considered as sort of genuine contenders to win the World Championship. I think, you know, they're going to be mid-table, I'd say, because they just haven't got enough batting strength.
Yeah, I mean, they do play India in a test series later this year at home. It would be fascinating to see how they get on, having made that leap against England, and how India cope with them and their pitches. You know, if there is something in the pitches out there, and that seems to be the way the West Indies have gone, helping their quick bowlers. Well, India have got a pretty good battery of pace bowlers as well. We've got the Test Championship coming. I mean, that might be, you know, more realistic for them. We've got the point system, 120 points for each series. It is quite complicated, and I think gradually as time goes on, we'll get used to how this is going to operate. But basically, if you have a two-match series, if you win a game, you get 60 points. And if you have a three-match series, you win a game, you get 40 points. And if you play a four-match series, you win a game, you get 30 points. And a five-match series, you win a game, you get 24 points. I mean, that would have been good, I think, for the game in St. Lucia, if teams were competing for Test Championship points. And I think it's great, actually, to get rid of the dead rubber. And every Test match in the future will have something riding on it. And I think that's going to be really good for the game.
But it is an interesting one, which I think will still have some evolution, because you pointed out, I think, that if you win a three test series, say 3-0, you get 120 points. And if you win a five test series, 3-2, you only get 72 points, because you're winning three matches at 24 points each. So slightly sort of weird. You get different points numbers for the same test wins in different lengths of series. So that might need looking at. But yes, certainly it focuses your attention more on the so-called dead matches. It's a great initiative, and I think it'll help test cricket ultimately. And great, well done to the West Indies. And, you know, we predicted a 2-1 verdict, and we were right.
We just got
the wrong team. I mean, fantastic performance by the West Indies. Great encouragement to their cricket. The pitches, I thought, were much more interesting than we've seen in the Caribbean over the last few years. That will encourage more quick bowlers, the likes of Shannon Gabriel. And there's some other people in the wings there that look quite exciting. Kemar Roach, a tremendous sort of second career he's having as a fast bowler, leading wicket taker in the series at 18, at just 13. I mean, you know, fantastic performance, and what a sort of great ambassador for the game as well. And despite that sort of silly little verbal spat on the last day with Root and Gabriel, I thought the series was played in great spirit too.
Yeah, I mean, I would go a bit further than silly. It needs sorting out, and you know, there needs to be a sort of clear definition of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, and the charge against Shannon Gabriel should sort that out, and you know, whatever the eventual punishment is, it'll be clear to all players what they can and cannot say on the field. You should say, well, that should be clear already, but you know, there are certain areas that are just totally unacceptable.
Well, certainly Joe Root got some credit generally for his reaction to what Gabriel said there, and hopefully it's not too much of a blot on an interesting series. England will come home with their tails between their legs, and their record in the Caribbean over the last 10 years or so is now played 10, won only two games, so they can reflect on where they went wrong and what to do next time they visit that part of the world. We now move on to the one-day series, of course, starting on the 20th of February in Barbados. And before that all starts, something completely different. The new Cricketer magazine is out. And just to sort of perk you up, in a way, before the season, after that disappointing performance by England, we've got four different covers for this month's issue, all of them featuring a beautiful ground in Britain, a club ground, and they are absolutely stunning pictures. We've got a big sort of 12-page feature section about the greatest grounds, the most beautiful grounds in Britain, just to uplift you all before the spring sort of finally arrives.
Excellent. I played on some lovely club grounds. Valley of the Rocks down in Devon, that's a lovely ground. I also remember playing in a ground in Wiltshire, where you were only allowed to play on Sunday if at 6 o'clock everyone stopped and looked at the church when the church, you know, when the clock struck six for 6 o'clock. That was the stipulation, and the game just had to come to a standstill. Everyone had to turn and look at the church, which was a fair enough compromise because it was a lovely ground to play on.
Yeah, I played on some lovely ones as well. And I know there's one in Devon, and I can't remember the name of it actually, but it's on a big slope, and it's got a stream at the bottom of the outfield, down at the bottom of the slope. And if the ball goes down, you know, downhill, it ends up in this stream, and they've got a local dog that actually goes and gets it out. So you have to play on not only with the ball all wet from the stream, but with dog spittle all over it. I don't know if that helps a bit of swing or not, but... Anyway, that's a sort of unusual idiosyncrasy of one English ground. And another one, my favourite, is the one at Ventnor in the Isle of Wight, where it's in a bowl. So you have to hit the ball up on all sides to get a boundary, because the wicket is sort of in the middle of this bowl, and you run downhill both ends to run into bowl. I was watching this beautiful game there a couple of years ago, which was coming to this exciting conclusion in this stunning surroundings, and it was a Sunday match, and the team bowling needed one wicket to win, and who was batting but an 11-year-old boy. And I sort of was trying to visualise my first ever club match as about an 11-year-old and batting at number 11 and trying to help my team to draw the game. And it was the last over. A spinner was bowling. He defended about four balls really well. And everyone was thinking, well, it'd be a lovely ending, you know, if the little 11-year-old boy managed to see his team to a draw. Everybody round the bat. And then about the fifth ball of the over, he just poked a catch to silly point. And the team winning the game just went absolutely berserk, jumping all over each other to win. And there was just the sight of them as they rushed off. There was just the sight of this little 11-year-old boy completely on his knees, totally crestfallen. And I just thought, what a sort of brutal game it is, really, in a beautiful setting, but sort of ruining a poor 11-year-old's day.
He'll learn, Oz. He'll learn.
Yeah. The brutality of the game, even in a beautiful surrounding.
Indeed. I mean, I've played on quite a few grounds, or ground in North London, used to Botany Bay Cricket Club, where there's a huge tree on the outfield. I actually mentioned this on Test Match Special last summer, and people sent me a huge number of pictures of grounds with trees on. I also find that a bit perplexing, really, as you know, if you're playing and the local rules, you have to know the local rules. What happens if the ball hits the tree? Anyway, I don't think I'm necessarily a great fan of cricket grounds with trees slap bang in the middle of them, but of course, you know, sometimes you've just got to adapt, haven't you? And you've just got to play on the land that you're given. It's, you know, it's great to have the land in the first place to play the great game.
Yeah. Well, anyway, look out for that feature in the Cricketer magazine coming out this week. And actually, also, if you have any grounds we haven't included that you think are worthy of a picture or two, please send those in as well to that same email address, theanalystpodcast@gmail.com. That's it for this week. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll speak to you this time next week.
Social Podcast Network.